Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. My guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books. His latest came out last week. It's called Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to the Present. Mark is also co-author, along with Anna Arutunyan, of Downfall, Prigozhin, Putin, and the New Fight for the Future of Russia. And he is the guest for the first episode of this podcast since Donald Trump's election to a new term as U.S. president. We're going to talk about what the election may mean for the war in Ukraine, first of all, but also for Russia and its relations with the United States and Europe. All of these are interrelated, of course. And also be picking Mark's brain about a specific aspect of those relations. Namely, Russia's sabotage efforts in the West. Thank you very much for joining me, Mark.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
All right, great to speak to you again. Now, the U.S. election is behind us, and Trump's second term lies ahead. It starts with his inauguration on January 20th, of course, but I'll introduce my question about what his victory may mean for the war in Ukraine by mentioning that Trump claimed several times during the campaign that if elected, he would bring the war to an end very quickly, even before his inauguration. He's spoken of 24, 48 hours. Obviously, the full-scale invasion is still raging on, and civilians in Ukraine are still being killed or wounded in Russian attacks a few days after the U.S. election. But far from the front lines, there's plenty of talk about how Trump may seek to end the war and whether such efforts could possibly be successful. Putin added fuel to this by saying on November 7th that Trump's statements about U.S.-Russia relations and about ending the war, quote, deserve attention at a minimum, unquote. So things seem to be getting off to a fast start, especially after the Washington Post reported yesterday that Trump and Putin spoke by phone last Thursday, which actually was the same day Putin made his remarks. But a little over an hour ago, I think, Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov denied that this call took place. One of the clearest denials I've seen from Peskov on anything. Usually he's a bit more wily. The Post report, it cited unnamed sources who said that Trump advised Putin in the phone call not to escalate the war in Ukraine. But in any case, Russia then launched a massive drone attack on Kyiv, and there's no sign of any let-up, phone call or no. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about the various ideas that have been floated for an end to the fighting, some of them presented to Trump by advisors. I'll just say that some involve using levels of military support for Kyiv, aid to Kyiv, to push both sides into talks, and that many of the plans that have been floated would apparently leave Russia in control of the Ukrainian territory it controls now, or at the time of an agreement, which is currently about one-fifth of the country. I'm talking about leaving Russia in control informally, presumably, at least for the time being. Now, it looks like Russia is now seeking to seize as much territory as it can, particularly in the Donetsk region, ahead of any potential negotiations. It also may be gathering force for an attempt to push Ukrainian troops out of the Kursk region of Russia, which they where they made an incursion in August and have been ever since. And I'll also mention one of the main concerns, I think, for Kyiv and its supporters amid all this talk about potential peace talks, the possibility that Russia might not act in good faith when it comes to negotiations, or even just a push for negotiations. It might use these efforts to present itself as an advocate for peace and encourage the United States and the West to withhold support for Ukraine while building up its own forces. But I'll stop there, Mark, and just ask you to lay out your thoughts or some of your thoughts on what Trump's election means for the war in Ukraine and for the confrontation between Russia and the West. And maybe one way to approach it is to ask what you'll be watching, what you'll be watching for as Trump's term approaches.
Well, in terms of what to watch for, I mean, I think it's not just about the statements. This is the problem. I mean, Trump says many things, some of which he follows through with, many of which he doesn't. So, you know, again, we have to be cautious about that. The composition of his team will be important because, again, Trump is, I think it's fair to say, not necessarily always a details man, and will depend on his team both to paint a picture of what's happening, but also to actually handle the nuts and bolts of whatever happens, as well as a certain amount of the sort of necessary negotiations. And also signs precisely of any of these plans that are being floated. And in some ways, it's interesting. It's very reminiscent of how Russian politics works, in that different individuals float different plans, in part to test them out with the rest of the elite, and in part to see if it gets the favor of the boss. And then sort of the boss leans in and says, we'll go with this particular option. That's much of how Putinism works, and it may well be also how Trumpism works. So, you know, I think, again, any evidence that any of these plans actually are beginning to gain traction on Trump and his team. But the problem is, as I say, I think we also have to recognize the degree to which we don't know. We don't really know how important this is. Trump has made claims. He's made statements. We've got these leaked plans. There's this suggestion that he warned the Russians not to escalate. And in that context, I mean, I don't actually think the large drone attack on Kyiv actually counts as a substantive escalation, especially because it's at the same time as when the Ukrainians are launching an unprecedentedly large attack on Moscow. I think it's just part of the dynamic of the war. But the thing is this, the realities of the war are such that it's hard at the moment to see any kind of route to the Ukrainians reconquering large parts, liberating large parts of the taken territories in the immediate foreseeable future. So either Trump has to essentially commit himself to continued long-term assistance, or yes, he is going to have to try and bring pressure to bear for some kind of short-term, not resolution of the conflict, but really something that is a ceasefire in practice, if not in name. And yes, the only instruments he's got at his disposal really are to threaten to withhold or expand military assistance. And in that context, I mean, the Russians have been betting on this for a while, just in case. They have been putting a lot of effort into expanding their control within the Donbass. I mean, it's worth noting, after all, that Svetlana Radakhin, the current British Chief of the Defence Staff, recently said that the most recent month has been the bloodiest for the Russians so far throughout the war, losing 1,700 dead and wounded every day. Now, you do that because you actually feel that you're on a bit of a time frame. And I think in this case, absolutely, the Russians are trying to ensure that by the time Trump is inaugurated, not only have they pushed the Ukrainians out of the Kursk salient, but they've also taken as much of the Donbass as they possibly can, precisely so that if then those front lines get frozen, they are in the best possible position for that. Of course, we should note that, I mean, clearly this would be their best case scenario. It's always possible that the Russians will overplay their hand. I mean, at the moment, they've been reaffirming their very maximalist demands, that they want all the regions that they have formally annexed, even though much of them are not under Russian de facto control anyway. They want to see a Ukraine that is demilitarized, with an army that could not possibly resist future Russian attacks. They want guarantees that it won't join NATO, etc., etc. Now, on the one hand, this sounds very uncompromising and unpromising. On the other, though, we shouldn't forget that the Russians tend to be very hard-nosed negotiators. And their usual practice is precisely to set seemingly impossible demands and claim that these are the absolute irreducible minimum, because then they anticipate that they will be sort of haggled down from impossible to merely ridiculous in the process. So actually, you know, if one's looking for possible signs of optimism, it may well be that the Russians are at least considering the possibility that they might find themselves in negotiations and are preparing their position. But as I say, if they push too hard, if they make Trump look, or feel rather, as if he's going to end up looking like a loser, which seems to be the thing that he absolutely fears the most, then it's possible that he will actually double down on support for Kyiv, and to do so without many of the constraints that the Biden administration has shown so far. Because we should remember that the Russians clearly wanted Trump to win. I mean, for all Putin's smirking claims that he favored Kamala because of her infectious laugh. But on the other hand, there's always a certain caution, a certain unease. The Russians are used to the Americans being the grown-ups in the room, shall we say. That they can be, you know, the Russians themselves can be the daring, risk-taking ones, and they can rely on the Americans not to overreact. They can rely on the Americans to mark out their own red lines, which basically means that the Russians know exactly how far they can go and will go as far as they can. With Trump, those red lines, they may easily change overnight. They may easily be revised retrospectively. I mean, if we do look at the first Trump presidency, actually the Russians were often rather more cautious when dealing with the United States. But nonetheless, if Trump feels that actually he will suffer, and remember, ultimately, Trump's primary allegiance is to himself. If he feels that he may suffer reputationally, it's possible, as I say, that he will get behind Kyiv. So, you know, it's a very complex and ambiguous position at the moment. I mean, on balance, this seems to favor Moscow more than Kyiv. But again, it's cautious. But on that point about good faith actor, look, of course, Russia is not going to be a good faith actor under Putin. And if he sees opportunities in the future, perhaps to further revise the situation to his advantage, there's no reason to believe he wouldn't, which is why, if this ceasefire is to be anything more than just simply a temporary halt in hostilities, if it is to be the basis of some kind of peace, even if not the final resolution, because in some ways, particularly if there's a land for peace deal, it will still be a breach of international law. But nonetheless, there have to be proper security guarantees for Kyiv in that. And I think we are approaching a situation, and this is something that Zelensky himself has intimated, that really from Ukraine's point of view, and especially if it's going to be expected to actually give up any kind of territory, it really only has two options. Either NATO membership with that nice, solid Article 5 guarantee that actually has real weight in a way that sort of ad hoc bilateral guarantees and so forth might well not, or Ukraine acquires a nuclear technologies program. Basically, it's NATO's or nukes, I think, will be the ultimate irreducible minimum of where the Ukrainians think their security guarantees are. And so, well, you know, we're in a very complex situation. I don't have a nice clear, this is how it's going to happen. And the interesting thing will be to see how, you know, a president who is essentially a businessman, who regards himself as the CEO of United States Incorporated, how he will see the potential trade-offs awaiting if he wants to get involved in trying to bring some kind of peace to Ukraine.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. NATO or nukes, I wonder which Russia would actually prefer to see. I can't resist asking what, if anything, you make of this dispute about whether Trump and Putin spoke to each other by phone on Thursday. Washington Post, citing several unnamed sources, said that they did and that Trump urged Putin not to escalate. And Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, today denied that the call took place.
Yeah, I always have a certain degree of impatience for all these stories that are sourced to a series of unnamed sources. If I were a cynic, I might suggest a certain degree of mischief aimed at Trump, or an attempt precisely to kind of communicate to the Russians, don't escalate, don't try and use this moment of opportunity. with a lame duck president and an incoming elected president-elect who may well be sort of favorably inclined. But I honestly don't know. I suspect this has essentially more to do with politics in America, which are not really my strong point, rather than anything to do with Russia.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Now, my second question is more narrowly focused, I hope, than the first one, but it's related to the war in Ukraine and Russia's relations with the West. I'm talking about what U.S. and European officials say is a Russian sabotage campaign. Now, this has been happening for a long time, but a recent development, I would say, was particularly striking. As the Wall Street Journal put it in an article last week, Western security officials say they believe that two incendiary devices shipped via DHL were part of a covert Russian operation that ultimately aimed to start fires aboard cargo or passenger aircraft flying to the U.S. and Canada. Now, these devices ignited in July at DHL logistics hubs in Leipzig, Germany, and Birmingham, England. Mark, what is going on here, I guess, is my question. And do you think it is likely to tail off, with the new U.S. Administration, or remain on roughly the same level, or even escalate in the coming months?
Well, let's first of all deal with the claims that actually these incendiary devices were intended as a preparation for a campaign against North America. As I understand it, the United States has actually, the security community has slightly downplayed this. It's mainly coming from the Polish security authorities, which are, I think it's fair to say, rather more hawkish than most. So I think that that's still uncertain. But on the other hand, there certainly has been an escalating campaign of sabotage and indeed assassination inside Europe, really for the past year or so. I mean, if one thinks, just this year, we've had Maxim Kuzminov, the Russian defector to Ukraine, who was gunned down in Spain, probably organized crime figures. We've had arson attacks in northeast London against warehouses that were being used for aid to Ukraine. We've had a whole series of arson attacks, cyber attacks and so forth on continental Europe. And indeed, the claim that there was an assassination planned against Armin Papperger, who's the CEO of the German arms firm Rheinmetall. And interestingly, whereas in the past, the Russians have tended to actually confine their direct assassination operations against people whom they consider traitors. So, Kuzminov, for example, or various Chechens organizing against Russian rule there, or Litvinenko and Skripal, Russian intelligence officers who've become British double agents in the UK, that kind of thing. Papega, not a Russian or anything like that. So in that case, it absolutely would represent an increase in the type of attacks being launched. And what seems to have happened is that a decision was made probably in the middle of last year, because it takes time to prepare these operations. And the genesis of that is precisely this belief on the part of Putin that Russia is at war with the West. I mean, he said so himself in his 2023 Victory Day speech. He said, a real war is being waged against Russia. In that context, you can go to prison in Russia for claiming that what's happening in Ukraine is a war, special military operation. But on the other hand, as far as Putin is concerned, he's perfectly happy to use the W word for the wider confrontation with the West, because he thinks of Ukraine as just one theater, a particularly bloody and violent theater, but just one theater in this wider war. Because remember, this is a man who doesn't believe that Ukraine really exists. And he thinks that it is essentially just simply being used by the West, by NATO, by the CIA, the MI6 and all the other bugbears as an instrument to undermine Russia. So in that context, we've generally seen a quite substantial escalation of Russian, not just intelligence operations in the classic sense of gathering information, but active measures, active attempts to do things on the ground, from disinformation to supporting divisive political movements to increasingly direct attacks. And I think that this represents several things. First of all, just simply an exasperation with the situation, particularly the political situation, a sense that support for Ukraine has just become a little bit too easy for Westerners and almost has been normalized. that people don't really think of the amount of money that is being spent on supporting Ukraine and what this means for domestic taxes and spending and the like. And an attempt, therefore, to actually make people more aware and to make people suffer as a result. I mean, I'm calling this the weaponization of inconvenience, because most of these attacks are seemingly fairly trivial. I mean, obviously, I'm not talking about the assassinations, but attacks on railways, ticketing systems, cyber attacks, or burning down a shopping mall or whatever. That is not the kind of thing which in itself is going to turn the whole war. I think it's more just an attempt to create, through an accretion of lots of small-scale attacks, a pervasive sense, firstly, that the West is not able to secure itself. Secondly, that Russia is able to reach out wherever it wants. And thirdly, that this is having a real effect on people's lives. You know, actually, not being able to get to work because the train systems are gummed up by a cyber attack, yeah, that has a real impact. Or if you're trying to get home from work because you've got to pick up your kid from school, you notice it if actually all the traffic lights on your road are, you know, stuck on red or something like that. You know, things like this. So I think it's an attempt to basically create an increasing climate in which Putin hopes that Western publics will begin to feel that continued support for Ukraine is just not worth it. It's just too inconvenient. Remember, he thinks that the key problem for democracies is that we lack willpower, that Russia's will, which essentially means his will and his will to allow Russians to continue to suffer in the name of his war. But anyway, that Russia's will is its secret weapon. So in a way, he's trying to play to that. And finally, Ukraine has been launching a series of attacks on Russian soil, some of which, and I don't mean any kind of value judgment here, but, you know, could be considered terrorist style in terms of assassinations, in terms of arson attacks on Voyenkomat draft boards and such like. And as I say, for someone like Putin, who doesn't really believe that Ukraine operates independently, I mean, which is bizarre given the degree to which actually we see frictions between Kyiv and many of its Western partners from time to time. But anyway, he's convinced, I believe, that Ukraine would not be launching these attacks without either Western instructions or at the very least Western approval. And therefore, I think there is that sense of, OK, if that's the way you want the game to be played, we are going to give you a taste of your own medicine. So, you know, for all of these reasons, I think we are seeing this increased tempo of attacks. Interestingly, North America, particularly the United States, has up to now been exempt. And I think to a large extent, it was precisely because they did not want to further draw attention to the threat posed by Moscow before the presidential elections. And now I don't think they're going to want to do it precisely because they don't want to aggravate Trump. And they have a much bigger picture in mind in that respect. So I think actually North America is likely to remain largely exempt from these attacks. But I see absolutely no reason for them not to continue in Europe. And indeed, if anything, escalate. Because the point is, these kind of operations, you know, some of them are very complex and sophisticated. Some of them are very, very crude. Some of them rely just simply on a physical attack, burning something down. Others we see sort of multi-layer. For example, there were recently some anti-Semitic graffiti that was daubed on Jewish memorials in France, which was then massively amplified by Russian disinformation outfits to present the sense that France was a country that was, you know, ripped between neo-Nazis and essentially a country that really needed to address its domestic concerns rather than be thinking about, as they will put it, meddling in Ukraine. So, you know, these are sometimes more complex than they seem, even though the people carrying out the attacks on the ground are often very uncomplex individuals, not card-carrying Russian intelligence officers, but sometimes ideologically supportive members of local communities, you know, extremists of the left or more often the right, or just simply thugs who have been recruited. I mean, as we saw with the arson attacks in London, it was run by GU, Russian military intelligence, but it was actually just carried out by just some local British thugs who were hired to do that. And let me publicized the fact that I've written a fairly chunky report on this for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime called Gangsters at War, which came out last month. But, you know, we see an increasing recruitment of these kind of proxies by the Russians precisely to carry out these kind of low level, but nonetheless accumulating these significant attacks. So the bottom line is America is probably continuing to be safe. Europe, I think, faces a growing problem.
Okay, that sounds ominous. And on that note, Mark, we're going to wrap it up there. I'd like to thank you very much for joining me again, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, great to speak to you. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies, and the author of books, including his latest, which came out last week and is called Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to the Present. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.